Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 89 degrees. That would match yesterday's high. Still cooler than average, though 97 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-60s. Sunny and warming up to 90 tomorrow before dipping back down to 86 degrees on Thursday. Right now, under sunny skies, it's 84 degrees. Native American leaders are protesting the latest plan by a Paris auction house to sell off part of their tribal history. Hundreds of religious items and art pieces from the Americas, Africa, and Asia are scheduled to go up for bidding Monday at a Paris auction house. KJZZ's Al Macias reports this is not the first time these kinds of artifacts have been up for auction.
The auctions have been a diplomatic issue for years between the United States and France. U.S. laws prohibiting the sale of Native American ceremonial items hold no weight in France. A Plains war shirt made with hair from human scalps and sacred Hopi objects considered to be living beings by the Arizona tribe are among the items scheduled for auction. Selling the mask-like pieces that the Hopi consider the physical embodiment of their ancestors is particularly offensive to the tribe. The Hopi argue their ancestor spirits are being sold off. Other objects include the Acoma Pueblo ceremonial shield, ancient jewelry, and effigies linked to the Hohokam, who once inhabited parts of present-day Arizona. France has a long history tied to its colonial past in Africa of collecting and selling tribal artifacts. Al Macias, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
When 200,000 households didn't get their publicity pamphlets in the time frame required before this month's special election, Secretary of State Michelle Reagan blamed a vendor error on the problem while also taking responsibility. But that vendor, IBM, now says it had nothing to do with the pamphlets not going out. Jeremy Duda wrote about this in the Arizona Capital Times, and he joins me. So, Jeremy, what exactly is IBM's involvement in all of this?
Well, IBM has been under contract with the Secretary of State's office for years. Their contract actually ended at the end of February. And they were what they described as basically a software integrator. They had kind of helped rework the software that they use so that it could be used by the Secretary of State's office for things like mailing lists, voter registration system. And this is the system that Michelle Reagan's office uses to compile the voting lists for the counties outside of Maricopa and Pima, those two counties, the two largest in the state. They send their own lists, and then for the 13 rural counties, the Secretary of State's office compiles the list itself, and that is where the problem was in this, in that about 200,000 households that had two registered voters did not, instead of getting two pamphlets, or even instead of getting one, they got no pamphlets, and that was the mistake.
Well, what is Secretary Reagan saying that IBM's responsibility was in this? I mean, if IBM basically set up the software, how is she saying the company was responsible for this erroneous mailing list?
Well, what her spokesman told me yesterday after I'd spoken with the folks from IBM is that they had the Secretary of State's office, because they have some new employees and a lot of the employees there who had more experience in using this system, you know, weren't there anymore. They had requested some information from IBM about how this system works, and it sounds like the dispute is specifically over what an IBM spokesman referred to as a functionality key, which is kind of a program within the software where they would allow them to kind of sort out the mail and do what's called householding, making sure you don't send the same piece to two different people in the same household, kind of the same thing that political campaigns do when they send a mailer to a household with multiple registered voters. And they're saying, the Secretary of State's office says that that IBM did not sufficiently inform them about this functionality key or query key, as they referred to it.
What does IBM say about that?
Well, I haven't spoken back with the IBM since I got that from the Secretary of State's office late yesterday. What the IBM had told me over the past couple of days is that basically this isn't their responsibility. You know, they integrated the software, created in 2011, they said, created this functionality key kind of in tandem with someone who was working up at the Secretary of State's office. And since then, their only involvement is that they're on contract to maintain and for maintenance and support and things like that. And that contract actually ended on February 28th. The Secretary of State's office decided not to continue it. IBM tells me over kind of cost concerns. I think it cost about $800,000 a year.
Did you get the sense in talking to the Secretary of State's office that they are looking to hire a new company to deal with this?
I'm not sure because, as I said, the contract expired almost 3 months ago. I do not believe they have a contract with anyone else since then. That's not the only vendor they have under contract. They have a software company that's been under contract for a long time as well.
This is not the first election that has happened since IBM has had this contract. Is the Secretary of State's office basically saying that had the employees who had been around for a previous election still been there, this may not have been a problem?
They didn't elaborate too much, but they did mention that the request was a result of the fact that there were a number of new employees, a lot of folks who'd been around for a long time and had a lot of expert experience using the software in, the 2012 and 2014 elections, weren't there. And that's why this additional information from IBM was needed. Now, interestingly enough, both sides kind of indicate to me that emails between the Secretary of State's office, which the Secretary of State's office has said it will provide, will vindicate their side. So it'll be interesting to see which one is, who is actually validated there.
We'll continue to read for updates, Jeremy, once you get those emails. Jeremy Duda is a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. He wrote about IBM saying it was not responsible for publicity pamphlets not being sent to voters in time for the May 17th special election. Jeremy, thanks as always.
No problem.
There have been 3 confirmed cases of the Zika virus in Arizona. It's by no means widespread yet, and state health officials are hoping to keep it that way. Today, the Arizona Department of Health Services met with officials from across the state to make sure everyone is on the same page when it comes to prevention and response. KJZZ's Kerry Young was there. And Kerry, what kinds of topics were covered in today's summit?
Well, like you said, today was all about making sure everyone's on the same page. So if we do have an outbreak, there's a solid and coordinated game plan. So there were sessions on emergency communications plans, how to identify Zika in patients and in the lab for all kinds of healthcare providers, and even a discussion about legal preparedness because the Zika virus is, well, it is a little bit different than other mosquito-borne diseases we've seen here.
How so?
Well, for one, there's more of a focus this time on preventing the infection of local mosquitoes than, say, the West Nile virus. So that's big because the cases we've seen so far in the state have come from people who have traveled to Zika-impacted areas and come back with it. So far, there haven't been any cases where people have not traveled and come up with the virus. And so when that becomes the case, that's when the chance for an outbreak is more possible. But as Health Department Director Kara Crist explained, this virus is also a little bit different because it means officials have to collaborate with a few different health experts than they've been used to with, say, the West Nile virus.
We've had to bring in maternal and child health and birth defects because of the impact that it's been linked to birth defects in pregnant women who have passed it on to their fetus.
Kerry, how concerned were people today that Zika would become a widespread problem here in Arizona?
Well, we are considered a high-risk state by the CDC, actually. And that's because we do have the type of mosquito that carries the Zika virus, and we are a border state to Mexico, which at this time is an impacted country. Now, the state of Sonora has not been impacted yet, so that remains relatively low. But right now, Director Crist says she is confident that the state can contain an outbreak before it becomes too widespread here.
We do anticipate we are going to get a number of travel-associated cases. We know that. We may get some local transmission in an area. What we think we are low risk for is for widespread statewide transmission of Zika.
That's the director of the State Department of Health Services, Dr. Kara Crist, talking about the Zika virus from today's Zika Summit in Phoenix. KJZZ's Kerry Young. Thanks, Kerry.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today. The line just got shorter, but you probably didn't notice it at your airport security checkpoint. They pulled somebody out of the line yesterday. The Transportation Security Administration replaced its top security official, blamed for all the long lines. Kelly Hogan had been the Assistant Administrator for Office of Security Operations.
But the wait times signify care in screening passengers, right? 3 hours in Chicago. Waits at New York's JFK Airport up 80% from last year. Many airports are trying to deal with this by hiring private security contractors to make up for a 10% decrease in employees since 2013, even though air travel is up some 12%. How much of the troubles at the TSA signify that the whole approach to aviation security is not kept up with changing technology, the changing nature of threats, or the realistic probabilities that an airplane will be a target, even given the EgyptAir disaster investigators are looking at this week? Bruce Schneier, a security technologist and author, says a whole new approach is in order.
Firings seem to be based on the fact that there are a lot of complaints and heads need to roll. Whether this will be changes or not remains to be seen. I mean, we're really just reading tea leaves at this point. So it's really hard for me to see what's going to happen. I think we do need some changes, and we'll see if Congress is willing to make them, if the TSA is willing to make them.
What about this front-end security and the way the United States has dealt with it in airline safety?
You know, it's a good question, and we want to separate two things here. One is whether the TSA is doing things right, and that has to do with the lines and the checkpoints and who's where and the staffing. And the other is what you asked, are they doing the right things? I think it's a real conversation to have, whether airport security is effective, what sorts of security we need in our country. But it's a very different sort of conversation and a hard one for us to have. My feeling is the TSA hasn't been doing the right things for a long time. Doing things right is really a matter of budget, and their budget's been cut. So we really have both problems to deal with, and they're very separate.
Given that the changes in the protocols there at the airport have been determined by, in many cases, you know, crimes that were about to be committed, the shoe bomber, and then now everyone's taking their shoes off, the liquid bomb assembly that was being done in Denver and was on its way to some airport somewhere, and they caught it in time, thank God. But that forced the change in everybody having to get rid of their liquids. Are you confident that the TSA is anticipating what's going to happen as opposed to waiting until something almost does?
Of course not. And that litany is an example of that. There's a shoe bomber, we take off our shoes. Liquid bomber, we screen liquids. Underwear bomber, we have full body scanners. I mean, all of those things are reactive, and that's why it doesn't really work. The goal isn't to protect what the terrorists did last week, but to anticipate what they do next week. And the liquid bomber is a good example of that, because they were caught in London in their apartments before they got to the airport. They picked a plot designed to get through airport security, and they were caught through investigation intelligence having nothing to do with airport security. And that's really where we have our successes in this country, too. You know, we don't catch stuff at airports. Airport security is the last line of defense and not a very good one. The best things we do are the things that don't try to guess the plot, the tactic, the target correctly.
What is the biggest security vulnerability at an airport? Is it at the front end or is it somewhere else?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer because you don't care about the biggest. You care what are the vulnerabilities. I mean, if you are a bomber, what you want is a lot of people packed tightly together. And they exist just as much inside the airport as outside the airport on the security lines. I mean, we don't want bombs to get on airplanes because they have a special failure mode, right? A small bomb takes down the plane, everyone dies. But if you think of all the places where people gather together packed relatively tightly, shopping malls, supermarkets, stadiums, theaters, we can just go on and on and on. You can't possibly ever protect them all. Even a country like Israel can't. So you just have to do the difference that makes airplanes more attractive targets. And then you have to realize that you're going to have to stop these people before they get to the location. You know, I'm in Boston right now, the finish line of the Boston Marathon, another place where people were packed tightly together that we never even thought of before.
And again, the response reactive. I guess I'm wondering if any of these soft targets of transportation facilities are, you know, adequately being looked at, and that the TSA is a holdover from 9/11 that was really, really important at one moment, but maybe has evolved past its usefulness in the way that we really, really need for the future.
I mean, that's largely true. The TSA was a reaction to the tactic of the moment. And while I don't say abolish the TSA, I think we should ratchet airport security back down to pre-9/11 levels. I mean, a lot of tests have shown that the TSA misses 70% of guns, 80%, I mean, crazy numbers. And you look at that and you say, wow, the TSA isn't really good at detecting these things. But then you have to say, well, then why aren't planes falling out of the sky? And the reason is there's nothing to detect. There aren't these terrorists coming through with guns and bombs, and our only defense is the TSA. So while we need airport security, I think we do need to back off and look at what the actual threats are these days.
How do you back off without eliminating the TSA and terrifying everyone, making them full of anxiety going to the airport?
Well, this is actually hard because it's not just the anxiety of the people. It's the anxiety of the elected officials. If you are Congress and you say, well, we don't need this, we're going to reduce the security requirements, we're going to go back down to pre-9/11 levels of security, and you get it wrong, you're out of job. It is always in the best interest to exaggerate the threats. So we're kind of stuck in a loop. We have to back off slowly. And you see us doing that somewhat with PreCheck. You know, PreCheck is very much pre-9/11 security if you're on the list. We're seeing much fewer liquid detections. Those rules are kind of backing off. You know, shoes are still being screened, but not as much. So slowly it's happening. But this is very difficult because, you're right, people might get anxious, and elected officials are scared for their careers if they make the wrong guess.
Is this a money problem that can be solved with increased funds, like, for instance, $7.6 billion that the president wants to give to the TSA for next year?
So certainly the doing things right problem can. Now, we've been discussing, are we doing the right things? But the doing things right, the lines at the airport, the delays, that is 100% caused by not enough money for agents and lines. We increase their budget, we will have fewer delays at the airport. You know, it's not going to solve what we're talking about, but it will make all of our experiences better when we get to the airport.
Bruce Schneier rhymes with, what did you say?
Frequent flyer.
There you go. Security technologist and author. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
And that's our partner at The Takeaway, John Hockenberry. The Obama administration's new rules on overtime have elicited swift reaction from both business and labor groups. Some observers believe the service industry will be among those most affected, and given the importance of tourism to Arizona's economy, that could have a significant impact here. For more on this, I'm joined by Laurent Badu. He heads the Employment and Labor Practice Group at Greenberg Traurig's Phoenix office. And Laurent, what do you think the impact of these new rules will be here in Arizona?
There are a number of different ways in which employers can actually address it. They can transfer the individuals to an hourly wage, which is somewhat, I believe, what the Department of Labor has in mind. They can up the salaries to the new threshold and make these individuals exempt at the new threshold, which in all likelihood is going to be a pay increase. Or they can work a series of other alternative arrangements. Where they're going to set the hourly wage is going to be the big component. You can do it by dividing the salary by 2080, which gives you an hourly based on 52 work weeks, or you can use a different number that may be lower because you're going to build in the hourly basis. And so what some people are afraid is going to happen is, let's say if I reduce the salary a little bit lower because I'm accounting for overtime, what if I manage the overtime so well that the person works less overtime than they used to and their take-home pay has decreased as a result?
Is that a realistic possibility?
Absolutely.
Is it possible that workers might just work a 40-hour work week?
It's entirely possible that it will have a beneficial effect on the quality of life. So instead of working 55 hours for a salary of X, you're going to work 45 hours on an hourly wage and get the same take home or close to it, maybe a little bit less money, but a little bit more personal time. So there might be a benefit that particular way as well.
For some of the workers who might end up with a little bit more leisure time, the thought is often, well, it's great. They can spend time with their family. They can do things that they enjoy. Do you get the sense that that will be how some of those folks spend their time, or will they have to go out and get another job?
There will likely be both. I think you will have some individuals who will use the additional time to secure an additional job to bring more money into their family. I mean, if you have two parents working for about $60,000 with a couple of kids or more, it's not a ton of money. You might have the desire to go out and try to generate greater revenue for your family. Does that open up a possibility? Yes. Is that the most desirable one? I mean, that's not a choice that I can really put a value judgment on. It's what might be best for an individual, and that might actually work out well. Although I think ideally, as a society, we'd rather have a primary job that pays you well enough that you do not have to feel the pressure of going out to secure a second or third one.
Do you think, bottom line, there are going to be a lot of workers in Arizona who are going to be getting pay cuts as a result of this, or maybe have fewer benefits?
It's really hard to tell. I think that there is going to be a move on some parts of the segment of the affected employers to perhaps, instead of having a full-time 50, 60-hour employee, to maybe divvy up that job into multiple ones and lay it over other individuals and maybe stick with part-timers to avoid the Affordable Care Act implications, to avoid the full-time benefits that may come with it and the overtime components. There's always that risk, and there's no mechanism by which the DOL, the Department of Labor, can get around that when they place those new regulations out.
Given sort of the schedule of businesses, when do you think they generally have to figure out how they're going to handle this? I mean, they can't do it like 2 days before, generally, I would think.
Yes, you would want to make sure that everything that you're going to put into effect is going to go into effect in advance of, so that the wages are being paid, are the wages being paid after the change has gone into effect. So you want to be clear also with the employees when the change is going on. There's no set requirement under law, but the more advance notice you can provide, the better off everybody's going to be. And if you can do it maybe a couple of months in advance of December 1st, that gives you the opportunity to make modifications if you see things that don't work well.
Laurent Badu heads Greenberg Traurig's Phoenix Offices Employment and Labor Practice Group. Laurent, thank you.
Thank you.
We hear a lot about the development in downtown Phoenix these days, and Old Town Scottsdale has long been a place to see and be seen. But what about Old Town Peoria? Haven't heard of that? Well, that's changing. The West Valley City's Council has big plans for the area near Grand Avenue and Washington Street, and the show's Lauren Gilger is here to talk about this. Lauren, what do they have in mind?
So the Peoria City Council just approved an initial land acquisition to buy three parcels near 83rd Avenue in Washington, where right now there are old boarded-up buildings just sitting empty. So the plan is to clear those lots and then work with private developers to redevelop the area.
What do they want this redevelopment to look like?
Well, it could look like anything. I went down to Old Town Peoria to see it, and I met Andy Granger. Andy's the city engineer for Peoria, and he's helping to plan this initiative with the city council. He says they envision it as a mixed-use kind of development, but in the end, it's not entirely up to them.
Maybe restaurants, it may be an ice cream shop. We're not sure, but it's probably going to be driven by the market. We don't want to have a franchise here. We want it to be an authentic area where it's a destination for people to come back.
Granger says they've tried to redevelop this area before using public money to build public infrastructure like their community center, but now they want to try a different approach.
We've taken the next step to try and redevelop this area by purchasing private properties that we'll work with developers on to rebuild these properties and try and revitalize this area to hopefully spur growth around this block, as well as not only just on this block, but around this block also.
Well, how long do they think it'll take this all to get going?
So it's already starting. I also visited Lucidity Distillery in Old Town Peoria. It opened up just a few months ago in the city's old fire station, and the city sees it as the spark that could help spur more growth.
Can we go take a look?
Yeah, absolutely.
In the back of the Lucidity Distillery, behind the tasting room and a locked door,
it's all locked down like this.
Gotcha.
There are hundreds of bottles of dark and clear liquor in neat rows.
So what you're looking at now is a three-year-old Canadian whiskey, and you're also looking at our forcible entry vodka, which is our flagship product.
The walls are decorated with firefighters' uniforms, an American flag made out of fire hoses, and the words Fire Station Number 1 painted in white. But this wasn't the way Chris Lucidity had originally planned to decorate his first distillery.
Well, we were going to tell our story. Technically, I'm a fifth-generation distiller. But from day one when we started demo, the firefighters started showing up. And we realized that their story was not only more important than ours, but it's their building.
The building was built in 1921 as a movie theater. Then in 1954, he says it became the city's fire station.
It was our only fire station in all of Peoria. But then Peoria didn't extend up to Lake Pleasant at that time either.
Peoria City Councilwoman Vicki Hunt taught at Peoria High School for almost two decades and has been involved with the Historical Society for years. The fire station moved in 2006, and the building sat empty for almost a decade.
The city had been using it for storage.
But Hunt says they knew the building was important to the city and its history.
We always said that we would preserve this building because of its uniqueness and the stories associated from the people who do still live around here and who remember it.
So last year, the city made a deal with Luciti, and the fire station-turned-distillery was born.
You know, when I originally sat down at a council meeting, I said this is not an if-you-build-it-they-will-come scenario. That was in February of 15. I was dead wrong. We have food trucks down here every Friday, 4,000 to 5,000 people. They closed down Washington Street.
And Hunt says that success has given the city the spark they needed in Old Town.
What we hope is that this will be the flagship for more people to say, well, look, they did it and it's crowded all the time. We can do it too.
But their distillery is only one part of a three-legged stool, according to Luciti.
You need, you know, the drink's great, but you also need food. So we need a restaurant down here. And then you need entertainment.
But he thinks all of that is coming.
I kind of hate the word, and I'm kind of a hypocrite for using it, but I think we can do something unique over here. Just the way that Grand intersects, the proximity to the 101, you got the Coyotes, hopefully, staying where they're at, and then even further down the road, you got the Cardinals. Now you got a casino that just popped up. You know, there's things happening over here, and I don't see a lot of roadblocks anymore. The barriers to entry are low.
Chris Luciti also told me he's purchased other properties in the area and has big plans for them. And the city says the next step is to have a study done to figure out what development in Old Town Peoria should look like, from streetscapes to what kind of architecture they want to adopt.
That's a lot to keep our eyes on. That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
Could Charlotte's loss be Chandler's gain? Earlier this year, PayPal picked the North Carolina city over Chandler and Tampa to house its new global operations center. But the online payment firm then backed out of that deal in the wake of North Carolina's HB 2, the so-called bathroom law. And Chandler officials say they're back in the mix now. Micah Miranda is the city's economic development director. And Micah, what was your initial thought when you heard about PayPal leaving Charlotte?
My initial thought was, I got to get on the phone and begin having a conversation with our contacts at PayPal to see how we can position Chandler for this potential expansion project.
Was there anything that the city learned by having PayPal pick Charlotte originally that you think you can use maybe in this reboot of the process?
I don't believe so. There were some internal decisions that were made at PayPal that really drove that decision-making process. But I think based upon our existing relationships with the company, we have a good idea of what they'll need and how we can facilitate any project here in the Valley.
Do you have a sense of who your competition is now?
I don't, and we haven't been given any indication.
Does that matter as far as like trying to get your presentation together? I mean, is it helpful to know who else is in the mix, or does it not matter to you?
You know, from a market intelligence perspective, it's important to understand what our competitive advantages or disadvantages may be. But Chandler is unique in the sense that we have so much to offer companies, and our existing relationship with PayPal is very good. They know a lot about us. They know a lot about the state and the region that they know what they're going to get by doing any project in Chandler, which is 100% support from the state, the region, and the city.
If PayPal were to pick Chandler for this facility, what would it mean for your city?
I think it would just reiterate the reputation that Chandler has as the Southwest innovation and technology hub. I mean, we're known for having innovative and recognizable companies start here, grow here, and choose to relocate or expand here.
Do you have any sense as to when you might find out if PayPal is picking Chandler or if PayPal is picking some other city?
PayPal is in their due diligence phase right now, and so we are continuing to have conversations with them, but we don't have a specific timeline.
Micah Miranda is Chandler's Economic Development Director. Micah, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it, Mark.
In KJZZ News, traffic coming into Arizona from Mexico has been steadily increasing in recent years. KJZZ's Dina Sieg reports.
Last year alone, that meant 8,000 more big rigs and 400,000 more passenger vehicles came into Arizona, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation, and nearly a million more people visited the state. Arizona's Transportation Department is trying to plan for this upward trend. An ADOT spokesman says the department is working to improve roadways and traffic flows at the border, with several projects in the works. That includes a study on how to build Interstate 11 from Nogales to the Hoover Dam Bypass Bridge. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A top national bond ratings firm calls the passage of Propositions 123 and 124 credit positives for Arizona and its school districts. Moody's Investor Services says in Credit Outlook reports that Proposition 123's boost in school funding is a positive for districts. The analysis doesn't change credit ratings, and the company noted Arizona will remain 48th out of the 50 states. That's in per-pupil funding. Proposition 123 boosts withdrawals from the state land trust and adds general fund money to boost funding by $3.5 billion over a decade. Proposition 124 lowered cost of living adjustments for police and fire pensions and also was a credit positive for state and local governments. That's because it replaces more expensive yearly increases. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
The Valley's higher education options have been growing, and a group of Catholic universities is coming together to advance their collective impact. The four schools which feature East Valley campuses are the College of St. Scholastica, Benedictine University, St. Xavier University, and the University of Mary. Maria Lochner, Arizona Regional Director for the College of St. Scholastica, is with me to explain more about the coalition. Maria, how much will this affect the individual colleges and students?
It has to do more with, I guess, marketing and presenting ourselves more than anything related to academia. So academia would still be run through our main campuses and the programs that we have accreditation for, the programs we're offering here, and they're not going to change. But what we are saying is there is a value to private, Catholic, higher, not-for-profit higher education, and this is what it looks like. So it has a bigger picture. So students don't feel so lost. I mean, in Arizona, there isn't a real strong culture of private higher education. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're trying to do is break down some of those barriers with a little bit more information about why and who we are and what it looks like and why it's different.
So there's certain things that maybe the universities being separate are not quite covering what a coalition may in fact cover.
I think it allows us to be more visible. Because when we're working together, we're not as spread, and we're not spread as thin. So by working together, we can actually be more visible in more places. We can talk about each other like I'm doing now, representing my college, but obviously representing the partners as well. And we feel comfortable doing that.
How welcoming has this community been to this concept? Because as you mentioned, there haven't been a lot of private universities around. We can name a couple of them, but there really are. It's been a real focus on the state universities here.
Yes.
So how has it been, and how have you been able to make inroads?
Well, I'll say it's very interesting. The welcome has been wonderful, and people are looking for something different. And, you know, not to say that the publics aren't doing a good job. They're doing a fabulous job. They've had to carry the burden for all this time without having anyone else to take some of the pressure off. The most important thing about it is being able to tell people, hey, look, there's something different that may be better for you. I mean, obviously, a private institution such as ours, we're all private and super small, may not fit everybody. I mean, people, if you're looking for that big college experience, you're not going to come to the College of St. Scholastica or Benedictine University. You're going to go to ASU or U of A or NAU.
With a coalition, does that make these universities more competitive as well?
So more competitive as our own unit, I think, absolutely, because we look bigger and we can talk about Catholic values-based education that's available here, whether or not it's at my particular school. A lot of people think, you know, that we should be competing with each other. And I think, you know, why would I compete with any of these guys? They don't have any of the programs that I'm offering. You know, so it makes more sense to collaborate and push our mission. I mean, all of us, we came here for a reason, and that the reason is to extend the mission of the college. So, you know, my college had a mission of, you know, let's go out there and educate as many people as we can. And they're not all coming to Duluth, Minnesota, so let's go find this demographic that is looking for the type of education that we offer but isn't going to go to Minnesota to get it.
Are there certain things that you really should be a part of the Catholic faith, or can you be comfortable going there without that?
It has nothing to do with being Catholic. So, you know, in fact, I can speak for my college. Our current students here in the Valley, I don't even know if 10% are Catholic, actually. We like to bring in diverse groups because we think that it enhances who we are, you know, and the whole idea of extending your mission isn't to clone people to be one thing. We want to teach people what they want to learn to help them be the best person that they can be.
Maria Lochner, Arizona Regional Director for the College of St. Scholastica. We've been talking about the new coalition, Catholic Universities of Arizona.
Mesa officials are trying to work out a way to keep their unique emergency response system going. The city has been developing a model of responding to 911 calls by sending out targeted services and trying to keep people out of ambulances and emergency rooms. Tony Lojudice is the Community Care Grants Administrator for the Mesa Fire and Medical Department, and he joins me. So, Tony, first off, can you tell me about how Mesa is taking a different approach to emergency services and response?
Sure. We noticed through our data that about of the 60,000 medical calls we receive each year, approximately 40% of those are what we call not emergent or low acuity, really urgencies. We know that it's not very efficient to send a fire truck with two paramedics and two EMTs for these low-level, low-urgency type calls. So we developed the community care program. We partnered with the private sector, some surrounding fire departments, and crisis preparation and recovery, which is a behavioral type of services, to deal with these low-acuity type calls, essentially basically partnering up the private sector with some of our firefighter paramedics, teaming them up, and they go out in special units. And their mission is to treat a person in their home or at their call point and refer them possibly to their primary care physician, to behavioral type services, or appropriate type of services. And the idea is to keep a person off the ambulance that doesn't need to be on an ambulance and out of the emergency department when they don't need an emergency department.
It also seems like Mesa is now looking at a model where some callers to 911 may be charged for the services that they require. Is that right?
Sure, yeah. Over the last 2 years, we've been operating under a Centers for Medicare Innovation Award grant, if you will, to help us test this program. We're in our last year of it, and we'd like to make it sustainable because it really does deliver efficient health care. Overall, it does reduce the cost in health care, and it helps our community, helps us keep our community healthier. So we're working with the insurance companies to develop a model, if you will, so we can get reimbursed for these type of services and sustain them throughout.
So this is more of a billing insurance than handing somebody a bill once you've, you know, treated them for something that wasn't necessarily a full-on emergency.
Correct. We don't want to hand somebody a bill. We want to work with the insurance companies and go through a very similar to the way it's done today. You go to the doctor, they bill the insurance reimburse you. So we're working on a very similar model, but we're also working with the insurance companies to where we contract with them to see their patients when they utilize the 911 system, where a claim doesn't really even have to be filed. We just show through the data that we've seen their patients and they reimburse us for our services.
Is there a concern that that might have a chilling effect on residents who don't have insurance, that they might not call 911 even if they might really need it?
There is a concern, and that's one of the things we're looking at out with now on how we develop it. Obviously, ideally, through the Affordable Care Act, the mission was to eradicate the uninsured. If they meet that mission, then great, then we don't have to worry about the uninsured problem. However, realistically, we know there is going to be a segment of the population that's uninsured. But moving forward, we're going to hopefully address that problem and work through some of those uninsured folks. If it means working with social services to find people insurance, then that's a route we can obviously take.
When do you think is a realistic time frame to have some of these agreements with insurance companies worked out and have this system up and running without the grant from the federal government?
Sure. I'm optimistic that we're going to do it over the next year and a year and a half to have everything in place and be able to sustain this program on our own.
Tony Lojudice is the Community Care Grants Administrator for the Mesa Fire and Medical Department. Vancouver has become the least affordable place to live in North America. The Canadian city has seen prices soar in recent years, pricing younger buyers out of the market. There's a claim that a flood of Chinese money is to blame, but are other factors at play here? The BBC's Edwin Lane reports on what's fueling the boom.
Okay. Right now, we're on Point Grey Road. It's considered the billionaire's road. Probably one of the best investments in Western Canada.
Brian Yan is a real estate agent riding the wave of Vancouver's booming property market. He shows me around a two-bed seafront house aimed at the super-rich foreign buyers that many say are pumping billions into the market here.
In the front, we have the Infinity Edge jacuzzi, wide plank floors, we've got polished concrete,
How much is this going to set me back, Brian?
$10.98 million Canadian.
In US dollars, about, what, $8 or $9 million? Who's interested in buying it?
A lot of international people. They might own in London, in New York, in Hong Kong, or in Peking. And it's for, like, the billionaires, for the centimillionaires. A lot of developers, local developers that are just, I guess they are taking advantage of the market.
You feel the market's acting irrationally at the moment in Vancouver?
Completely, yes. It's irrational. If you look at the prices and the graphs, it's completely off the charts.
Vancouver real estate is red hot, and it's not just at Brian's millionaire end of the market. The cost of an average home in the city is rising at a rate of between 20 and 30% a year, in a city where incomes are among the lowest in the whole country. As the Royal Bank of Canada put it recently, Vancouver is becoming dangerously unaffordable.
Price increases have been dramatic, in some homes as much as 40% a year.
David Eby is the member of British Columbia's Legislative Assembly for Point Grey, Vancouver, and the housing spokesman for the main opposition party, the New Democrat Party.
It's having impacts on our economy and the ability of businesses to grow. And it's also having an impact on people's well-being. Vancouver was found to be one of the least happy cities in Canada.
What's behind this crisis?
Very significant inflows of international money into our housing market. We saw in the international media, Lawrence Fink, who's the head of BlackRock, the world's largest investment firm, tell international investors from around the world, they have $4.3 trillion under management, don't invest in gold anymore. Invest in condos in Manhattan, in London, and in Vancouver, British Columbia. And to people who lived here, that seems so crazy. Why would Vancouver, BC be on that list of international investors as a place to put their money?
So where is all this money coming from? One of the things you really notice walking around downtown Vancouver is, first of all, how big the real estate industry is here. There's an advert for a real estate agent on almost every city bus that goes by. And the second thing you notice is that most of them are marketing directly to Chinese investors and Chinese buyers. A lot of them, in fact, are written in Chinese. Until just 2 years ago, the Canadian government offered foreign nationals residency in exchange for an $800,000 loan, a program enthusiastically taken up by wealthy Chinese. David Lay is a geography professor at the University of British Columbia.
Associated now with these networks, these tight networks that exist between Vancouver and Asia Pacific, is investment in property, both by the business migrants themselves and by offshore investors. And now we have reached an extraordinary level of investment here.
Campaigners say something needs to be done to curb foreign investments and make it at least possible for locals to buy a house. But the debate is being hampered by a lack of data. Cameron Muir is the chief economist at the British Columbia Real Estate Association, the trade body that represents real estate agents. He says the influence of foreign money in Vancouver is being vastly overstated.
What we look at is the best available data. Based on that evidence, we don't see it as a significant issue as is being told in the media. Now, yes, absolutely, foreign investment is a factor in Vancouver. But to say that somehow foreign investment is making it unaffordable for first-time buyers to get into the housing market in Vancouver is a bit of a stretch.
We always laugh because it's a lot like the tobacco executives saying there's no proof that smoking causes cancer.
David Eby again.
We really desperately need people to come and live here who have skills. What I believe we don't need is a lot of millionaires to move here to support the local Ferrari dealership, which we now have.
That's the BBC's Edwin Lane reporting from Vancouver on the astronomical rise in house prices across the city. Could surgery someday be done on autopilot? A scientist at the University of Arizona is working in that direction. Yerzy Rosenblit's research focuses on guided systems and simulation. He's a professor in electrical and computer engineering at U of A and has a joint appointment in the surgery department in the College of Medicine.
I would call it a computer-assisted surgery, and of course our focus at this point is mainly on training for minimally invasive procedures such as gallbladder removal, typically called laparoscopic surgery. So we emphasize kind of a non-patient-based learning environment where residents, students can hone their skills without having to sacrifice animals. It can basically carry out the training task over and over.
So how does that work?
In essence, what we're trying to do is to provide or use technology to help trainees understand how to carry out certain movements, for example, how to cut, how to suture, by providing both visual and haptic, or as we say, force guidance. So what we're trying to do is, in essence, provide, quote-unquote, a set of training wheels.
What is driving your development of these techniques, and what's the utility in having them?
Well, clearly, you know, sort of an overarching goal and passion, of course, is to improve surgical outcomes and improve patient safety. So simulation has been really shown in the literature to clearly be a very effective tool, in essence, to allow you to hone your skills, be able to practice in a very, very safe environment, at the same time in an environment that does emulate very well these days, given the state of technology, the types of procedures that you would be carrying out in the operating room.
So what would be the next step? I mean, can you imagine a scenario under which surgery would be performed by someone or something other than a trained surgeon?
It's an excellent question. The thinking is that we will definitely transition from open surgery to more sort of a laparoscopic, endoscopic procedures with a very strong computer assistance that, in our view, really provides improved situational awareness. I think it's difficult at this point to imagine that there will be an acceptance in 5 years or 10 years from now for a totally automated process, but perhaps 20, 30 years from now, some of the surgical steps will be carried out pretty much autonomously and automatically.
Do you think that would be just for particular kinds of surgeries?
Most likely, yes, right. And of course, the trend is to minimize the trauma to the patient. Therefore, the procedures that lend themselves to minimally invasive approach are clear candidates.
I ask because, you know, the old saying about, you know, a minor surgery is defined as a surgery on somebody else. So, like, I'm just curious, like, any surgery obviously has its risks. And once you go in, you in some ways,
correct,
don't know what else you're going to find. So
correct,
it seems like it would be helpful to always have a real life person there who can sort of override the computer if need be.
That's the key. You know, we are dealing with a biological system. So your point is absolutely spot on. We are not dealing with an artificial system. There's clearly a deterministic design. Let's say if there's a failure on my in my laptop, I can replace the chip or the motherboard or power supply, and that's very predictable. And as you said, once the surgeon goes in, anatomy differs. Every patient is different. It's a biological system. Therefore, I think that the human in the loop is still the key. Are we going to carry out surgeries in a manner that would, in a sense, be akin to an autopilot in an airplane? My thought is that we're still going to be landing, taking off and landing the plane with the autopilot somewhere in between, and maybe that's the most appropriate analogy for where we're going to be 10 years from now, 15 years from now.
The surgical autopilot goes in,
right,
and then
right,
finishes, but
right,
there's still a real live person in the middle, like,
absolutely,
doing the actual work.
Right, absolutely. So I think, in fact, you know, aviation analogies are so appropriate now in technically based medicine, which obviously surgery is.
Yerzy Rosenblit is a professor in electrical and computer engineering at the University of Arizona. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.